Welcome to this edition of the Pepperdine People Podcast. I'm your host, Rick Gibson. This series captures some of the outstanding learning and outreach opportunities available here at Pepperdine. Each episode features interviews with exceptional members of our community and the special people who visit our campus.
Thank you for joining us for episode 23 of Pepperdine People. I'm Ted Garcia. Today I'm joined by Dr. Randall Holcomb, professor of economics from Florida State University. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thank you.
You are going to be speaking here at Pepperdine about the Bush-Obama stimulus program and the future of American capitalism.
Right.
Not only a mouthful, but that's a big topic. How do you even tackle something like that?
Well, it is a big topic, but I think there's a unifying theme in that topic, and that is that a lot of what's gone on in the face of this financial crisis has put programs in place that undermine some of the fundamental incentives that make our capitalist system work. And I'm going to talk about several things in that talk. One thing that people don't recognize too much is the big role that the Federal Reserve Bank has played. I'm going to talk about the TARP program. I'm going to talk about the bailouts. But one of the key things to understand just right up front is the way the capitalist system works and the important function of profit and loss in a capitalist system.
What are some of those?
Well, when you look at what businesses are facing in a market system and you look at how well off we are, how prosperous we are, that's because of entrepreneurs who have looked for profit opportunities. They look for ways to make your life better and my life better, not because they're so interested in us, but because they see that there's a profit in it for them if they can do that. You look at people from Henry Ford to Bill Gates to Steve Jobs, and those guys saw opportunities to innovate, to advance our standard of living because they could make a profit from it. And that profit really serves a dual function. On the one hand, it gives them an incentive to do good things for everybody else. And secondly, it's an indicator. It's an indicator of how well they've done because lots of people have started businesses. They've tried to innovate and it hasn't worked out well for them. And the flip side of profit is loss. Okay. So what the profit does is it provides a lure, an incentive for people to take risks, an incentive for people to be entrepreneurial, an incentive for people to be innovative. But on the flip side of that, the possibility of loss gives them an incentive to be cautious, to not take too many risks, to keep those risks in check. So to have a market system work, you need to have that profit and loss in place. So I'm going to talk about a lot of specific programs in both the Bush and Obama administrations. But one of the key things linking them is that firms that were taking losses and that should have borne the burden of those losses, the government ended up picking up those losses. So what it does is it gives companies an incentive to excessive risk-taking in an economy because what we're telling them is – if you make profits, you keep those profits. But if you take losses, the government will support you.
How does that work with the banking industry right now?
Well, we see it with a number of banks under the TARP program. Now, the TARP program is kind of an interesting program. It's a little bit more than a year old now. And when Secretary Paulson announced that program at the end of last September, he said we're in a crisis situation. He strong-armed Congress into passing that program. They passed it in less than a week after he said we needed it. And he said the reason we need that money is to buy up toxic assets that these banks are holding. He said the problem was there was a lending markets had frozen up. Banks wouldn't lend to each other because they weren't sure of the financial condition because of these toxic assets, those mortgage-backed securities. And so Paulson said what we need to do to free up the banking system is to buy up those toxic assets. And so Congress appropriated $700 billion to do that.
So in other words, this was the bailout money that people are talking about?
That's the bailout money. And the reason it was appropriated was to buy those toxic assets. Okay, now a year later, we look back and let's ask ourselves, was Paulson right in what he said? Did we actually need to buy those toxic assets? And we can see the answer is no. And the reason is we didn't use the money to buy the toxic assets. What Paulson said we needed to use the money for, we didn't use the money for that. What we ended up doing was the Treasury took an equity interest in banks. So partially nationalized banks took over part ownership of a number of banks. And so, you know, first of all, you see the money wasn't needed to buy the toxic assets because that didn't happen. What we did instead was to use the money to partially nationalize the banking industry. Now, ask yourself, at the time this program passed, if Paulson had gone to Congress and said, we want to nationalize the banking industry, give me $700 billion, how would that have worked? But yet, you know, essentially that's what that money went for.
But now there's talk of giving these big bonuses again to the banking executives. So there's outrage over that.
Well, there is, and the banking executives may well deserve that money. So I'm not going to pass judgment on that. But one thing you notice is now that the federal government has equity interest in those banks, they think it's their business to dictate to the banks how their executives can be compensated. And another thing worth noting, when the Treasury took equity interest in those banks, that Secretary Paulson strong-armed a number of banks into taking that money. He got the CEOs of the nine largest banks together, and he said, all of you need to take this money. We're taking partial ownership in these banks. You all need to take the money. The reason we don't want anybody to opt out of this is because it would make some banks appear weaker than others, and we don't want to give the impression of weak banks. So everybody has to take the money. So some banks didn't even want to take the money, but they were forced to by Secretary Paulson. And of course, now we see them scrambling to try to pay that money back because they see what strings are attached to it. But Secretary Geithner now is reluctant to let him pay it back, and he's got the stress tests and everything. And no, it's too early to pay the money back. So once the federal government's got its hooks into those banks, it's hanging on.
Now, what about the bailout of the auto firms?
Yeah, see, that's an interesting case too, because again, this you go back it was a little less than a year ago now. GM and Chrysler were having financial difficulties, and the firms were going to the federal government trying to get a bailout, and they had their eye on the TARP money. And Secretary Paulson said, no, that money is for financial firms. It's not for auto bailouts. We're not using the TARP money to bail out the auto industry. So Congress then considered whether they wanted to bail them out. So they had hearings, they had the bills and everything. Well, the bottom line is Congress said, no, we're not providing any bailout money to the auto industry. So then Paulson takes the TARP money, which he said was for these financial firms only. Paulson takes the TARP money and uses that to give a bailout to GM and Chrysler. Now, you know, sometimes things are easier to see in hindsight. But okay, now with hindsight, let's go back and say and look, you know, was that a good idea for the Bush administration to bail out the auto industry in December? The argument was, if we don't give them this money, they're going to go bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was we gave them the money. Then when Obama comes in, he gave them more money. And they still went bankrupt in June. See, so the bailout money didn't prevent the bankruptcy. What it did was just put a bunch of federal money into those firms before they declared bankruptcy. And the result of that is now the federal government owns those auto companies too. It owns 61% of General Motors because of the TARP money.
So what your argument is that this undermines the incentive structure, right, that makes the economy work?
Exactly. Those companies should have failed, right? And if there were any assets left in those companies that were productive and worthwhile in bankruptcy, either they could have reorganized and come out of bankruptcy. You recall a few years ago, Delta Airlines did that. It's the largest air carrier in the United States now. You know, they went into bankruptcy, reorganized, came out a healthier firm. So General Motors and Chrysler either could have done that, or if it wasn't possible for them to reorganize, any assets they had that were worth anything could have been sold to somebody else. Now the federal government owns most of General Motors. It owns a bit of Chrysler as well. And again, you know, ask yourself, would we have been better off to let them go bankrupt in December and the firms would have stayed in the private sector, those assets would have stayed in the private sector, or would it have been better for the government to essentially take over ownership? Like, say, it owns 61% of General Motors now. And there's a lot more to that story too, because the federal government, I think, took advantage of its position in claiming that ownership share of General Motors, that there were secured debt holders that should have been in line in any normal bankruptcy proceeding, would have been in line before the federal government, before the United Auto Workers, who also got a big ownership chunk, and they were put at the back of the line. They ended up – the bondholders ended up with about 10% of the firm. And so here, secured debt holders that should have been paid off first in bankruptcy end up losing a bunch of money on that. And there are so many problems with that. One problem is that it takes away from the very notion of secured debt. See, so now when people are saying, should I lend money to this firm, I'll be a bondholder, that'll put me first in line in case of any problems. Well, we see now that's not true. You know, so it undermines the security of secured debt. And it also creates a big problem for General Motors. I mean, I don't see how General Motors is going to ever be able to survive, because when you look at how auto companies are financed, they're financed through a combination of debt and equity. Who's going to loan money to this company that's 61% owned by the federal government, and the federal government has already shown that they'll strong arm the bondholders to take away any secured debt holdings that they have? So it just – it puts a huge financial burden on General Motors. I mean, set aside the cars, the problems with the unions and everything else, how are they going to operate in financial markets when essentially this part of the financial market will be closed off to them?
Now, one other thing that a lot of people are talking about is healthcare reform and how that's going to impact the economy. What do you have to say about healthcare reform?
Well, it's a big issue, and exactly what we might be doing about it is undecided as we speak. Mm-hmm. One of the big problems with it is the potential for it putting a big financial burden on the economy. I think in healthcare is a little different from some other issues in that the actual healthcare that's being provided probably isn't going to have a big economic impact. And here I'm thinking in contrast, for example, to energy policy. You know, when we talk about the cap and trade policies and so forth, I mean, there the costs of those policies can put a big burden on the economy. But with healthcare, mostly it's taking care of people who aren't really being productive in the economy. I mean, a huge chunk of healthcare expenditures goes for people who are elderly and retired, or people who are not in good health and aren't going to be productive workers anyway. I mean, one of the nice things for you and me is mostly, you know, if people are healthy, they don't need that much healthcare, and the healthcare they get tends to be pretty cheap. So the really expensive stuff is going to people who aren't adding that much to the productivity of the economy. But the question is, how much of a cost burden is that going to put on firms and taxpayers?
But can you take a look at how much they've put in the past, or just what their potential is in the future?
You mean as far as the cost is concerned?
Yeah, as far as they may have put in quite a bit in the past, but they're not contributing to the economy right now.
Oh, you're thinking about like people who are on Medicare.
Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they paid in. So in that sense, maybe they're entitled, you know,
right,
that they've been paying those Medicare taxes their whole working lives. Now they, you know, maybe they're entitled to some kind of health care. And that's the question. You know, what kind of health care are they entitled to? Now, one term that you hear thrown around all the time is rationing. You know, that if the Obamacare passes, there's going to be rationing of health care. there's always rationing of healthcare because there's not enough so everybody can get all that they want. Sometimes it's by price rationing, you know, where people will say, yeah, I can't really afford to go to the doctor. I'll probably get better on my own. Sometimes insurance companies or HMOs will say, here are the treatments that we'll finance. We won't pay for these other treatments. But, I mean, the fact of the matter is on any good that resources are scarce, and so you have to ration somehow. And the question is, how is that rationing going to take place? Now, you can easily foresee the likelihood that if we go more toward federal oversight in healthcare, there's going to be less healthcare that's available for people who are on Medicare right now. And the reason for that is that right now, if you're on Medicare, you just go to the doctor and you decide when you need to go to the doctor and what treatments you get, and then Medicare reimburses within some limits on that. It's easy to see that you may end up having some kind of gatekeeper who says, no, you can't get this treatment. No, you're not eligible for that. I mean, there are a lot of unnecessary tests, maybe unnecessary treatments. So I'm not passing judgment saying that's good or bad. Right. I'm saying people on Medicare aren't going to have the same options that they have now.
So where are we now? Are we coming out of a recession? Are we still in the recession? What's your opinion about that?
It looks to me like the economy is recovering. Yeah, I think we're coming out of the recession. I think when we look back, we'll see at this point, here we are in mid-October. I think we'll look back and see around August or so that the economy started picking up. So I think we're coming out of the recession. But I think it's going to be a slow climb. One thing is that just in general, unemployment tends to lag the economic recovery. So unemployment can still rise even though the economy's picking up, real GDP is growing, but yet we still may see some increases in unemployment because it tends to lag the recovery. Also, I think the stimulus package that we passed last winter really is going to be a burden on the recovery, not a help, because it's taking money out of the private sector of the economy, putting it into the public sector of the economy. And with limited resources, the more the government spends, the less is available for the private sector. So I think as the economy recovers, that stimulus bill that we passed is going to end up being more of a burden than a help in the recovery.
That's interesting. What do you think the future holds for the economy? Where do you think we're going? Where do you think we'll be next year, next October?
Well, I think we'll still be talking about the economy coming out of a recession. When you look at unemployment rates that we've had in the past under 5% and so forth, well, we're not going to be there next year. So we're still going to be talking about a sluggish economy. We're still going to be talking about an economy coming out of a recession. We're still going to have some fragility in the economy, and one of the problems that's likely to occur, be interesting to see, is I'm thinking there's going to be some inflation on the horizon.
Really?
People hear talk about deflation, and indeed, year to year right now, the consumer price index is down from where it was a year ago. A lot of that is a decline in energy prices, but over the long haul, the amount of inflation that we have is determined by the amount of money that's created by the Federal Reserve. And right now, there are a huge amount of excess reserves in the banking system. So there's a potential for those reserves to be lent out, which would end up increasing the money supply, which would be inflationary. Now, there's a way out of that, and that is that the Federal Reserve can mop up those excess reserves in a number of ways, but every way would require an increase in interest rates. So if we're going to contract those excess reserves that we have, every way to do that requires an increase in interest rates. And Ben Bernanke, chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank, may be reluctant to increase interest rates as long as the economy is sluggish.
Because housing, that's also going to put that back again, right?
Well, housing, business loans, all of that. And so Bernanke's going to be reluctant, I think. I mean, he's already said he's going to be reluctant to increase interest rates. But in order to mop up those excess reserves, that's what you need to do. So when is it going to happen that Bernanke says there's a threat of inflation, so we need to raise interest rates and try to mop up some of these excess reserves? Is it when the inflation rate gets up to 3%, 4%, maybe 5%? Right. But the thing about monetary policy, this is a tricky thing. So Bernanke's got a tough job, you know, in any event. But there are long and variable lags in monetary policy. So when the Fed does something, it might take a year or 18 months for the results to show up. So if we're looking, you know, we start looking and thinking, oh, inflation's up like, you know, 3%, 4%, you know, 5%. We need to do something. At that point, it may be too late to keep it from going to 8 or 9%.
Because of the lag.
Because of the lag. Okay. Exactly. So we act now, but the effects aren't going to show up. We have a lag and we
end with unemployment. The lag there is right, could keep going higher even though the economy is getting better.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah. So so I would – you know, 5 years from now, I'm sure the inflation rate is going to be higher than it is now. And where it'll be, I don't know. But I wouldn't bet against in the neighborhood of 5 to 10%.
Interesting. Thank you very much, Dr. Randall Holcomb, professor of economics from Florida State University. Very enlightening. Thank you.
No, thank you. It's delightful to be here.
And I'm Ted Garcia. Thanks for joining us today.